Hello and welcome to People in Profit. I'm Charles Pellegrin, and today we delve into the risky and murky world of commodities trading. Whether it's oil, grain, metals, or derivatives of all the above, they're traded globally by private companies that make their living, and so much more, by mastering the art of buying and selling from exactly the right place to exactly the right people and at exactly the right time. The story of these companies and traders is one that neatly tracks the history of the world after the Second World War, except that for these traders, every geopolitical crisis turns into an opportunity for profit. And that story has been beautifully told by Javier Blas and Jack Farchi in their book, A World for Sale, which also now has an official French translation. Author and Bloomberg columnist Javier Blas is our guest today. Thank you for being with us.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me.
So let's start at the beginning. This is around the time of post-World War II reconstruction. How did these traders and these trading companies end up holding so much financial heft when it used to be that the producers of commodities were the ones with all the power? What happened?
Well, they were the first winners of the globalization. The war, and particularly the reconstruction of Europe, required huge quantities of natural resources. Remember that European integration started with an association for steel and coal. And the traders were behind all of those new developments, supplying the new materials that they were needed. And there was a need to connect more suppliers with more consumers that required middlemen. And that's how the industry started. And then we have several developments through the 20th century and the beginning of the 21st century, from the collapse of the vertically integrated oil companies, the nationalization of the oil fields in the Middle East, then the collapse of the Soviet Union and the emergence of China as a big consumer. And all of that benefited commodity traders.
So you mentioned this is a story of globalization. How would you define the role of some of these trading commodities like Mark Rich & Co. That they played for developing nations? In the book, you use the example of Jamaica, which uses the services of these commodities traders to get their bauxite, which is used for aluminum, onto global markets.
There are two very important questions for the commodity traders. One is that these are companies that they are buying and selling the actual commodities. They are not playing on the derivatives market, on the futures market, like in New York or in Chicago or in London. They are buying actual commodities and they are selling the actual commodities, whether it's a barrel of oil, a metric ton of aluminium or copper, or a bushel of wheat and corn. For the developing countries, often they are the largest buyer of the commodities that they have to sell, but they provide more because often they act as financiers. And when these countries lose access to the global financial market because they are in a crisis, typically the commodity traders are the lenders of last resort. We have seen countries that they were unable to access the global financial market, whether it was tapping banks in London, in New York, or in Paris, that they were able to obtain credit lines with commodity traders. And then it's also where it gets interesting, because if you are the lender of last resort, you kind of become involved in global politics. You are saving countries. So the role of the commodity traders go beyond business and start to have a political shape.
That's right. It's saving countries, but it's also kind of an a savior of last resort. And they almost offer security the way that the mafia offers security. There's no other option. It's a very troubled relationship.
You are right. When you have to ask money to a commodity trader, you have lost access to every other source of financing. And then they're going to impose punitive terms. They are going to make money, significant money. But the commodity traders are willing to deal with any country that there is in trouble. And often they became financiers of wars, because when a country cannot access the global financial market, it's typically in a war situation. We also see then financing governments of all kind of political colors. I once asked a commodity trader how it was possible that simultaneously he was financing the government of Augusto Pinochet in Chile, a right-wing government, and the government of Fidel Castro in Cuba, a communist government. And he looked to me and said, well, I don't care about political colors, red or blue. The only thing I care is the green color. That's the color of the US dollar.
It's definitely a tale of the 80s and 90s, kind of a lot of Gordon Gekko type characters in this book. Well, actually, over the years, and you mentioned it, the business of commodities trading kept evolving. You mentioned that there was actual cargoes of grains and metals and oils being traded, that that's what they do. But eventually, when they come to the 80s and 90s, these traders start using new financial instruments, and they're backing up these real barrels of oil with options and derivative products. So they get into the financing game. Tell us more about this. What does this mean? For example, you use the term paper barrels.
Well, what we call paper barrels are different. We have two kind of barrels in the oil market. We have what I call the wet barrel, the actual, the liquid barrel of oil. And we have a paper barrel, which is simply a financial instrument, which ultimately is backed by a wet barrel. But in essence, is a piece of paper, a contract that indicates ownership of that quantity of barrels. That market started in the 1980s. The futures market for oil is relatively recent. It has been used a couple of generations. It started in the 80s in New York, followed later in London, and what allowed the commodity traders is to make huge financial bets, not just on cargoes of oil that they own it, but just on multiply that at times by 10 times on the financial market. They also were for the first time able to hedge, to insure against a movement in the price of oil, so they were able to trade more barrels because they have effectively reduced the potential for losses. And all of that triggered an explosion of commodity trading and oil trading, particularly in the early 1990s when this market really completely develops.
All of this is happening, and for a very long time, in an almost entirely unregulated environment. It allows these traders like Mark Rich to cut deals with literally anyone on the planet, whether it's apartheid South Africa or the Ayatollahs in Iran. How do they manage to work in such secrecy and for so long?
Well, there are several reasons. One, a lot of the companies that today dominate the commodity trading industry remain private. They're owned by either the employees or perhaps a family or a couple of families. There are very few of them that they have gone public. Perhaps the most the best known company that has gone public is Glencore, that listed his shares in the London stock market about 15 years ago. But at large, these companies are publicly owned, and therefore they have to make very little of public declaration with respect to their financials. There are some of these companies that today refuse to publish their financial results. So we don't know how much money they are making. We ultimately get to know because there are always leaks, but the companies, they don't want to comment on that. The other thing is that the commodity markets today remains largely unregulated, at least the physical market. There is regulation for the financial market where those paper barrels that I was speaking earlier are traded. But when it comes to actual transactions of physical commodities, there is very little regulation. And therefore, it allows the companies to fly under the radar. And there is also an interest when you are making a lot of money financing countries, perhaps during a civil war, the least that these companies want is publicity. So secrecy is what rules this business. And even today, some of these executives never speak in public. They never give or rarely give any interviews, although the industry has opened a bit over the last 10 years. It remains quite discreet or secretive by the standards of any other industry.
Mm-hmm. I'd like to focus on the figure of Mark Rich for a bit. He's almost a tragic sort of villain in the story. What makes him the consummate commodities trader? What does he represent?
Well, Matt Rich was the pioneer of oil trading. He was not the one that did the first oil trade, but it really became the big trader in oil in the 70s and 80s. And he really represented what we have come to know of the commodity traders operating in secrecy, making a lot of money, backing countries in financial trouble, and almost operating outside the law or at times borderline. I mean, famously, he was indicted of several crimes, including trading with the enemy, with Iran, by the U.S. authorities. He evaded those charges because he flew from the United States into Switzerland. He ultimately was, later on his life, pardoned by President Bill Clinton on his last day in office. But it's just that kind of figure that really still kind of projects a shadow over the industry. And importantly, he was the creator of his own commodity trading firm, Matt Rich & Co., which later split into two other companies that we call today Glencore and Trafigura, which happened to be two of the world's largest commodity traders. So the life of Matt Rich continues today, just not with his name, but through the companies that he helped to create.
Mm-hmm. And these companies are much more, for lack of a better word, mainstream than Mark Rich & Co. were publicly listed. And they sort of had to put behind them some of the swashbuckling ways of the second half of the 20th century. But in your book, you hint at the fact that that other trading houses, for example, in China, have sort of taken up the mantle of trading, for example, sanctioned Iranian crude. Would that be where you pick up the sequel to this book? If you write a sequel, would it be especially interesting to look into this, especially in the wake of, for example, the full-scale invasion of Ukraine by Russia and the whole shadow fleet and everything?
It's true that what used to happen with the commodity traders in the West, particularly the traders that were based in Geneva, today we see it more with the traders located in the East, whether they are operating from the Middle East, locations like Dubai, or from China or Singapore. But we have seen a new wave of commodity traders who are making the money dealing on sanctioned barrels, whether those are from Iran, Venezuela, China. The profits are huge. Bear in mind that even at current oil prices, the total value of the production, the oil production of Russia, of Iran and in Venezuela is close to $1 billion a day. And that's even taking in account that those countries are selling their oil at a discounted to global markets just because of the sanctions. When the potential turnover of those barrels is $1 billion, the potential for profit is also very high. And it's not surprising that we have seen a new wave, a new cadre of commodity traders emerging from the East, that they are making a lot of money trading on those sanctions, oil barrels, and other commodities. And yes, the world remains for sale, as our book says. And I think that if I was, Jack and I, we were to write a second part for the book, probably we'll have a lot of focus on what is happening today in the East, and particularly what is happening in China.
Javier Blas, you're the author of A World for Sale. You're also a Bloomberg columnist, and you were our guest today. Thank you so much for sharing your insights.
Thank you so much.
Well, thank you for watching People in Profit. If you enjoyed this, please make sure to subscribe to our show, to People in Profit, on the podcast platform of your choice. In the meantime, do stay tuned for more news on France 24.